to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking with you about bugs today. One sign of fall is when insects begin making their way into your home. We'll talk about that today with Phil Pelletieri, my guest. He's an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. So, what do you do to prevent insect infestations in your home during fall? Maybe you're struggling keeping insects out of your house. Maybe you've got another kind of problem. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Certainly, we always love to hear from you. And if you got a great insect photo, put that up on our Facebook page as well. Or maybe an insect you want identified, we'll take a look at on our Facebook page. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Well, fall means cooler temperatures and falling leaves, and that also means that some insects are going to find their way into our homes.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yesterday, I was out in the woods walking around between Iowa and Grant County, and we had frost in part of the state on Sunday night, and it was relatively cold, and that was the trigger, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, there was Asian lady beetles everywhere. And that seems to be the pattern that we see, is you need that cold trigger, and then they start looking for shelter. And so, sure enough, the buildings had them all over the sunny sides, and the box elder bugs were there. And this has been a good year for cluster flies, which are another fall invader, and it's just a story of all these critters are looking for shelter. They all sneak in during the fall, and then you pay the price all winter long till next spring.
Any health problems associated with, you mentioned cluster flies.
Not so much cluster flies. Asian lady beetles, when you bother them, they bleed through their joints. It's a defensive mechanism they have. And there are people who have developed quite severe allergies to these, because it's a protein that they're leaving in your environment. And that constant exposure is a problem. So normally you don't consider it, but this is one that, yes, people have had some real difficulties to the point in some cases having to move because they just couldn't tolerate how contaminated the house became.
You know what? Sherry in Watertown has a question that relates right to what we're talking about. So let's just go there. Hi, Sherry. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the box elder bugs. When they were outside, they weren't too obnoxious, but now they're starting to swarm on the sunny side of the house, of course, and they're getting in, they're coming in like in between the windows, and I'm seeing them on my walls, not in huge numbers, but enough to notice.
The inside of your walls, you're saying?
The inside of the house.
Okay.
And on the floors, I'm sweeping them up all the time. Or are they good for anything, or can I just kill them? The birds do not seem to be reducing.
Yeah, no, they don't like them.
Being that bright color, they honestly are very distasteful to most birds.
Right.
It's one of these things, you can make the argument if you really want to get in their biology. They feed on box elder seeds. They affect their viability. Many people consider box elders a weedy tree, so maybe they help control box elders. So that would be the one nice thing I could say about them. But the sheer numbers you deal with and whatnot, there's no reason to not get them outside. And, the one thing that you shared with us that I would suggest is, you can spray them with soapy water. You can spray them with insecticides outside. Once they're inside, I'm a big fan of just the vacuum cleaner. But you know where the weakness is. If you can see where they're crawling underneath, this is something that if you can make a structural adjustment, if you solve the riddle how they're getting in, you have a permanent solution. Whereas, all my sprays and whatnot are only temporary. So now would be the time to spray the outside, as I said, with soap or whatever. But I would look into, caulking, screening, whatever you can do, because that really is the ultimate solution. And if you solve it, then you won't have this problem indoors anymore.
Is it too late now to apply that
sprays?
Spray at.
Well, for cluster flies, my fear, because I've seen them come in for over a month, that you're going to get mixed results. You can't kill the ones that are already in the walls. But the other ones, considering how warm it is staying consistently, you know, I can see at least 10 days out more invasion, and who knows, it, you know, this
with elder, with box elder,
with box elders and Asian lady beetles, it will not stop until the temperature is consistently below about 45 degrees. And as I said, there's nothing in the horizon looking that. So, as I said, if you're having problems now, it's worth putting up the fight, because you can't let them get in the walls, or then you might as well, as I said, there really is no easy solution at all. There's no sprays, right?
Yeah, yeah. Get the old vacuum out.
Is there a formula for the soap spray?
Yeah. Well, one of my favorite stories, in fact, I even have it in this book that I'm supposedly writing. we were here talking. My colleague down at Iowa State shared with me, it was a half a cup of Tide powder detergent or liquid detergent to a gallon of water. And as we're doing the shows, a caller came in and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. Well, it turns out soaps have different chemistries to them. And so the one thing that I know works, you can go to the local nursery store and they have insecticidal soap, and it is the right stuff. And that's all it is soap. You can experiment with other soaps and detergents, but I'll warn you, even one batch of Tide apparently is not necessarily the same as another batch. So it gets tricky. Mild solutions, 1%, 2%, you don't have to get very strong. And the other part of it, it's all contact. So if you put the soap and they show up 20 minutes later, the soap is dried, it will not affect them. And so that's the limitation of the soap treatments, is it's only what you see in front of you at that time.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks for calling. You know what? Carrie in Fort Atkinson has something along these lines. Let's go there. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Just a couple of quick things. We're having a pile of them this year, more than ever. Probably a lot of people are.
Box elder bugs you're talking about.
You bet.
Okay.
And I was just listening, and I missed what you said about where to get the insecticidal soap. That's one thing.
Yeah. I mean, it may be hard to find at a hardware store because it's kind of a specialty product, but you've got a chance. But definitely a plant store, a local flower shop, nursery.
Nursery. Yard and garden.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a number of formulations, and it's all the same stuff and the like.
Okay, it's probably on the label.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And one product is Safer's, but as I said, I know there's other manufacturers of these products. And, the thing about box elder bugs, there's two generations a year in what tends to affect them. They have very few natural predators, but they do have a natural disease that's dependent on a lot of moisture. So for as wet as we were early in the season, I thought, maybe not going to be a bad year. But we were so dry in August, and the second generation just did very well. So I typically, during droughty late summers, is the years that we expect the most box elder bugs.
Yeah, I think the first year we ever had them here, it was 1988 when we had a drought.
Yeah.
And I thought they were kind of pretty, and then we got a bunch of them, and that was kind of the end of my liking them.
I understood exactly, Carrie, what you're talking about. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, my goodness. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. And, again, if you've got an insect photo, a cool photo, or maybe you want to have Phil identify a particular insect, he can give that a shot, too, with a photo on our Facebook page. So go ahead and do that. Aaron in Oshkosh, it's your turn. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking the call. This will make my significant other very happy. So two seasons now, same time of year, same problem. Outside planters on the porch, on the north side of the house. We get these little things that appear to be fruit flies. They are small, little pests, and then, of course, they will come in through the crack of the screen door, get into the kitchen. They do not respond very well to the fruit fly remedies of traps with vinegar and even some store-bought ones. And the whole infestation tends to last like 2-3 weeks, and the missus gets all upset about it. And then we wind up not being able to bring in the plants to save them from the frost, because the one year that we tried, they just sprouted everywhere. Any advice? Is it fruit flies, or what can we do?
Yeah, I'm leaning against true fruit flies, or what I call a fruit fly, because they typically need to feed on decaying fruit that has yeast associated with that decay. But there are fungus gnats that would love to breed in the potting soil, the plants that are outdoors, and that's my suspicion. They're just not quite as robust in the shoulder as a fruit fly. The other thing you can look at is many of the fruit fly species we have in the state have red eyes, whereas the fungus gnats are just little gnats.
Yeah, these things are really tiny, sir.
Yeah, like, yeah, that fits then. So because they're breeding in the potting soil, you know, if you used a standard insecticide and drenched it, what we find is many times the drenches will hurt the roots, and so you set the plant physically back or even could kill it. But there are bacterial products that are sold, again, at nursery stores and the like, that are very selective. You can argue they're organic. And what they do is they kill the maggots of these fungus gnats. And so what I would suggest is buy this product. You just, you know, mix it with a little water, drench it on like you do your normal watering, and it will stop the breeding. But yet then if you've got pets, kids, whatnot, there's no concern there. So I think that's a good way, you know, and preferably you would like to treat a week or so before you bring them in, just because it gives the chance. You're not doing anything for the adults. What you're doing is shutting down the reproduction, and that's how this product works.
There you go.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Let's take a look at Facebook for just a minute, because Dan on Facebook sent a photo of a spider that you stretch the legs out over 3 inches long and wondering what the heck it is.
So, you know, do a little bit of a double take. Because of the banding on the legs, it looks like one of the many orb weaver spiders we get in the late summer.
Yeah.
They're all very colorful. You see sometimes this kind of sculptured abdomen to them. The other spider that we get that is humongous are the big wolf spiders. But wolf spiders tend to be wandering hunting spiders, so you see them running around. They're not in a web, whereas what's classic of the orb weavers is they create these nice little webs. In fact, these are the same webs that you see in the nice dew-filled mornings that are just everywhere out in the grasslands and the like. And because of their size and color, they really do catch people's attention, and they're really one of the most harmless spiders. In fact, one of them, if you want to go back to Charlotte's Web, is the star there. So, you know, the orb weavers are again, very common late summer. What you're seeing are large females. These spiders typically will lay an egg mass that gets through the winter, and the adults will die, but it could be well into December if the weather allows.
And there's already another photo from Cheryl up of an orb weaver.
Right. And again, that banding of the legs is the first thing I look at, which is classic of them. And some of these can be orange and red with cream-colored spots. As I said, they're really very artsy-type spiders.
Yeah.
People like to take pictures of them.
Cool photo.
And the like. And this one appears that it has caught a prey and wound it up. But you will also see these round egg balls at times in the egg masses. In the webs.
So. Yeah, that's an interesting photo because, as Cheryl points out, the image in the pod looks like a human
face,
skull. <Yes. laughs> and it's really
kind of
just
fitting for Halloween, I think.
But it's just a prey that something that the spider caught and is wraps it up in a little pod.
You know, it's a tough group to look at because if you look on the internet to help you identify it, in a given species, they're quite variable in color. In markings. And so, you know, it's hard to give people, some of them like the black and yellow Argiope, or, you know, the black and yellow garden spider, people like to call it, is pretty easy. But some of these other ones, the barn spiders and the shamrock spiders and whatnot, fit in this group. It's tough. If you really want to delve into it, you know, the best photo ID website I know is Bug Guide. But I'll warn you, go to Orb Weavers, and you can probably spend about 4 days going through all the pictures. So,
there we go. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the UW-Madison, where he headed the Insect Diagnostic Lab for many a year. I'm Larry Mueller. Breanne Schesso, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say to Phil Pelletieri, our UW extension entomologist. He has many, many years in that role, and it's always great to have him come back. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. David, thanks a lot for calling from Washburn.
Hi, gentlemen. My question, I live in this old farmhouse, and trying to keep the beetles out is nearly impossible. We get the cluster flies coming in August, and then now the lady beetles are coming. I have an exterminator spray, usually sprays about the first week in September, but I just wondered, does the spray last? Is there a better time to spray than just as the cluster flies come out, or Should we be more in between the two? What's the optimal time to spray to get both buster flies and lady beetles?
Yeah, it depends on how the fall weather goes. I think the first week of September is a very good choice for cluster flies. What you're going to suffer from this year is this warm October is allowing the bug season to go late enough that I wonder how much residual. It depends on what formulation you use, what side of the house. But when you start getting out 5-6 weeks, you really start to suspect that the product is not going to hold up that long for you. And so, as I said, if it was a cool fall and, you know, the weather wasn't conducive for bugs coming anymore, one spray would have been sufficient. But, you know, one of the worst years I ever saw for Asian lady beetle, the trigger didn't come till Halloween. It was really kind of funny because I remember it was just when this was just starting in the state back in the 90s. And one of the names for this insect at that time was Halloween beetle. And I thought it was because the pumpkin, you know, orange color of the back of the beetle. But then I started to think, well, is it because they all come in at Halloween? Well, again, from experience, we now know is that we need that kind of hard frost trigger or you know, decent frost. And then when we get these beautiful days in the fall, they start coming in. And that can happen as early as the end of September if we have an early frost. And this year, as I said, to me, it really didn't start to take off until Monday morning.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, David. Appreciate the call. Let's switch gears and talk about ants a little bit next. Here's Joe in Franklin. Hi, Joe. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a question about the red ants. You know, the little common red ants, and it usually seems like the end of August, beginning of September, all the nests hatch at the same time. The drones, the queens come out, and they'll just, you think your yard, you might have a couple ants' nests, turns out you've got 30 of them, and there's ants all over the place. How do they coordinate it? How do they know this is the time? Is it, you know...
Sure.
The temperature, the hours of daylight?
Yeah, it's probably day length induced, and different ants swarm at different times of the year. The carpenter ants are May and June. In the fall of the year, in these late summer afternoons that are nice and sunny, it's typical either cornfield ants, which are the ones you've got, which are the smaller red ants, and they're very common. I've seen estimates that it's not uncommon to see, you know, 9 to 10 colonies per square yard in a lawn. But then the other ants that will do this are the formica or field ants, the big mound-building ants, which are, you know, 2 or 3 times the size. They also have this late summer, early fall swarm. And again, what's so interesting is you can go out there in the morning, there's nothing. You go out there 2 in the afternoon, there's ants bubbling everywhere for 3 or 4 hours. And then you start, and this swarming might go on for 4 or 5 days in succession. If the weather turns kind of nasty, they might stop for a while. But it's a pretty predictable phenomenon. As I said, it's got to be day length induced for it to fit that much. Now, once in a while, what we'll see with some ant species that come out when the books tell you they're not to, there's usually an interesting scenario. And so like the citronella ants that we see in the spring, if they're nesting underneath the foundation of a house, which they do, they will start swarming in March. Because it's so warm, they're tricked into thinking it's spring. So in that case, it's temperature induced. But for these late summer ones, as I said, it's got to be day length.
You mentioned thanks again, Joe, for calling. Appreciate it. You mentioned the big mounds and so forth, or the bigger ants. And I think Nancy's got something about that from Oregon. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. My question is, we got these huge mounds. Some of them are like a foot high and maybe 4 foot across. And it's a property we bought not quite a year ago, and we've been clearing a lot around the trees and opening things up. Can we get rid of those mounds without creating a mess?
You can, but it's going to be labor intensive, and it's some of the ants involved with it. This is in that group that we call field ants, and some make huge mounds. Some even honestly will affect the vegetation around them. I've seen them kill Christmas trees, you know, because they don't want the nest shaded. But the problem with them is the colony can go for 10 to 15 years. The queen is down in the ground. And so you put anything on the surface and don't get it down to where the queen is, you will be very dissatisfied. And so the typical trick we use is I'd go out there with a garden rake, rake some of the soil away, and you're going to see 4 or 5 channels where the ants are bubbling out. Be a little careful. They don't sting, but they bite. You know, they do, if you give them the chance, they'll give you a nip. But so once you know where those 3 or 4 channels are, I'll usually use a big metal rod or something similar and push it down in so that I'm basically getting as deep into the interior of the nest as I can. then any garden insecticide that's mixed up, you know, for a nest that's very large, it might take a gallon or two of diluted product to work, and you pour it down those channels that you created. And what that gives you a good chance is to get it deep enough to get it to the queen. She's the only reproducing member of the colony, so control is all about killing her. If you kill her, colony's done. If you don't kill her, it will continue to go on. And as I said, so it's all about, so, you know, if you've got 40 acres and it's got hundreds of nests, I'm not sure that's practical, but, you know, if they're close to where the kids play, or you've got some particular trees that looks like they might be messing with the root areas and whatnot, then I think it's well worth treating.
They're doing that, and we probably have four huge ones, and then we got some smaller ones right around some trees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there any special insecticide we should use?
Any garden insecticide will work. One of the old classic standbys for ant treatment is the garden insecticide 7, which is often used as a worm killer and the like when you know, on your cabbage plants and the like. But there's almost anyone will be effective. Now, what we, you know, some of the home remedies we've seen thrown out, like hot pails of water and boric acid and whatnot, really don't hold up. I mean, I really have not seen any evidence that those work. But anything that has normal insecticides that would be used in the garden, other than the bacterial products and stuff that are only for caterpillars, so kind of a broad-purpose insecticide. And as I said, the normal dilutions, but you want to soak or drench in order to get success.
So, you're not going to work. It's not going to work unless you drop
right. You know what? A lot of people would get powder and they dust the top, and it's like you shut the light off. The ants stop being active because the chemicals literally repel them, so they don't come out for a while. You come back a week later, and they're just as happy as they can be.
Yeah. Good luck, Nancy. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to turn to Scott in the Green Bay area, north of Green Bay, actually. Hi, Scott.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, you may or may not have heard, there's been some black widows we found on our property. Actually, they're on the house. And it didn't bother me too much, but my wife doesn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wondered, is it even possible? Is there any way to deter black widows that you might know of?
What's interesting, you know, you have the state spider experts up your way. Mike Draney's up at UW Green Bay. And,
right.
And, you know, I had seen Mike a couple weeks ago. He was down in the department giving a seminar.
In fact, we brought it over to him.
Yeah. There's something going on this year, because although I historically have seen a couple records of it, this seems to be a banner year for black widows. And,
right.
You know, the problem, you know, they're typically a spider that likes clutter and quiet. And so that's why they talk about, you know, them being in attics and the like. Outdoors, I think rock piles and such are the kind of habitats they're looking for. And so about all I can suggest is try to keep things open, airy, get rid of as much clutter and debris as you can. Mm-hmm. would deter them from trying to be around there. Because I said, they're really very secretive normally. And you really have to, in most cases, go hunting for them. And in all my career here, I have never known of a documented case of somebody being bit by a black widow in Wisconsin.
Oh, that's good.
I was told, you know, back in the 1920s and whatnot, that hospitals would have records where people were being bit when they'd go into the outdoor toilets, the outhouses, and they'd sit on them. And, of course, the spider took great offense at that, and that's why they got bit. But, you know, that tells you the kind of secretive, out-of-the-way kind of places you normally would expect to see them. And the other problem we've got is there is a relative of the black widow that is not poisonous, Stidodia, which is a very common spider, much more common than black widow. But we do have black widows. We always have. And for whatever reason, up in that Green Bay, Door County area is one of the hot spots, as is in the very southwest corner in Grant County.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Like, we have, like, these outdoor porches. I'm just thinking, you know, obviously, if it's dark under those porches, would that be a good place for
yes.
them to hide out?
Yes, definitely, definitely.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Back to Facebook for just a minute. We've got a long green caterpillar-like thing Katie wants us to identify.
If you look on the very back, there is a horn. It happens to be a green horn. In some of these species, they're red horns and black horns. With the markings on it, I know it's in the family we'd call hornworms or hawk moths or sphinx moths. With the markings of that, I'm guessing, because I can't see the sides as well as I like to, it's called an ash sphinx moth. So it feeds on ash trees. What's classic of most of those species, they don't spin cocoons, but they burrow in the ground to pupate. And so you often see them when they're crawling around looking for a place to go, and that's how they spend the winter. And then these very interesting moths come out in the late spring and early summer that remind people of hummingbirds in many cases.
Cool photo. Patty in Eden, it's your turn. Hi, Patty. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. I just wanted to give a quick way to get rid of fungus gnats. I've used it for every time I've had a bad problem with them. When I bring the pots in, I just stick yellow sticky traps up vertical in the pots, and I'm rid of the fungus gnats and the babies that hatch thereafter.
Wait a minute. What do? You stick the...
yellow sticky traps.
Yeah. Where do you put... how do you put them?
They come with a little peg that you can insert in your pot.
Okay.
And then you it's vertical, and the fungus gnats are attracted to that yellow, and they all cling to those sticky traps. And then when the babies hatch, they're all gone too.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. Their success will depend on how much organic matter is in the soil. So if you use a normal potting mix, there's not anything to sustain them. But if you're using garden soil, or if you've got dead leaves and other things that fall on the surface, that helps fuel the populations. But, you know, it's hard getting organic matter out, per se. And but you'll see that influence, too. The more organic matter there is in the soil, the happier the fungus gnats are. Another way of assessing if they're around, and this, again, comes from a colleague that's at Colorado State. He takes a piece of potato, just a slice, and he puts it on the top of the soil, and he lets it sit for a day or two, and the maggots crawl up into there. And so that's a way of assessing if they're in an individual pot. They're dark black-headed maggots. Their bodies are white to clear, and you know, they're not very big, only a couple millimeters long, but, you know, the gnats aren't very big either. But that's a way of at least assessing, because, you know, some pots, again, can be problematic, some can't. But the problem is, if you've got a big plant collection inside, you don't want to get this started, because it can bother you all continually. I mean, they'll breed continuously.
Yeah. Patty, thank you for calling. Back to Facebook for a minute, just because there's a bright orange, I think orb weaver, I'm not positive, that Allison sent us a photo from last Friday.
Right, and I'm thinking that's one of the shamrock, what is sometimes called the shamrock spider from just the coloration. Again, I'd have to see a little bit more of the markings, but you can see why I said they really make great photographic subjects.
Oh, man, that's a really cool. I've not seen one of those in the wild, it's orange, I guess?
Yeah, orange, and there's one that's sometimes bright red with white cream markings. And as I said, it just...
beautiful.
You think it's something more tropical than what you'd expect in Wisconsin.
Sue in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Yeah, good morning. I have this very interesting bluish-black insect that I've never seen before. Again, I'm in Castful by the river. It's about an inch and a half long, and I've seen it crawling around on the ground in the back end of this insect is segmented, maybe three or four different sections. Any idea?
Quite a few possibilities, but the one thing I'm suspicious of, because there's one that is just kind of stunning if you see it, there's a group of beetles we call blister beetles. And what's unusual is blister beetles are soft-bodied. They're not hard-bodied like a normal beetle. Now, there's a whole bunch of different kinds, but there's one that almost looks half ant, half beetle. I mean, it's a crazy looking thing, a bright, deep metallic blue to it. And I know it as Moloe, M-O-L-E-O is the scientific name, but it is technically a blister beetle. And I wonder, some blister beetles are parasites of grasshopper eggs. Other ones are parasites of bees. They have some very interesting life cycles, but look up blister beetles and particularly this Moloe and see if that fits. That would be my first guess. There are some ground beetles that have some metallic sheens, but not quite blue. And then everything else starting to get into some wasps and some other creatures, and I think they would be distinctive enough that would catch your attention. But I said, do look up that blister beetle, because that would be my first guess.
Yeah, I will. It certainly does have the look of an ant as well. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Evan in Madison up next. Hi, Evan.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just real quickly, any suggestions for how to deal with ground bee nests? And I'm also wondering how they go about picking a location. What are they attracted to?
Basically, they're not the best diggers. These are all paper wasps, really. And there's a ground nesting group, and there's an above ground nesting group. They're looking for old gopher burrows, washed out pockets underneath slabs. So they're looking for pre-existing cavities, and they will nest in people's wall voids sometimes. And so you've got two choices. They're within a couple weeks of dying off, you know, and it really isn't as much the cold as they run out of food. And the way they get through the winter is the new queens that have already been fertilized crawl under a rock somewhere, and then they have to start everything from scratch. So in the spring and early summer, there are so few of them, it doesn't catch your attention. By the late summer, the colonies can be in the hundreds, if not a couple thousand, and this is where we get the unfortunate cases, including me. My daughter just bought a new house, and I was trying to clear some pampas grass out, and all of a sudden, I apparently cut someplace that they weren't happy about, and they let me know about it. And so I had to wait until Monday morning when it was cool enough that I knew I could go out and work. But if you can't, if you have to deal with it, you know, it's right next to your front door and you just don't feel comfortable going out. The secret for ground nests to me is to use a powder, not a spray. And what we tend to find is the powdered insecticides, if you put in the hole, when they crawl in and out of it, they pick it up and it does them in very quickly. If it was an above ground nest, I like the aerosol wasp killers. They work very well, but we've been very disappointed generally with the results because you're spraying the entrance of the nest and the true nest can be 2 feet away. I mean, just depending on what the burrow looks like. So, but the good news is we're late enough now. As I said, I can assure you, even for nests that are in people's houses, it doesn't matter if it's warm enough. They have no food. They starve to death. And so I usually use about the 1st of November as my cutoff date for when the colonies are done.
Almost exactly a month ago, I was stung about 5 times and along the side of the house. And then come to find I had a bag of soil that was half a bag, and there was an opening that, you know, that wasn't completely closed, and they're making a nest inside that. And I, you know what, I'm just more careful. I know that in a couple of weeks they're going to be gone, but I took a few stings.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem is typically, you know, they're really not that visible until things are disturbed. But if you go over them with a lawnmower or you're out walking around and your foot slips in, I mean, we get into some really, really potentially dangerous situations with the sheer numbers. And the thing to keep in mind when they sting you is their stinger is not left behind like a honeybee. And so one is capable of stinging you multiple times. And it's rather classic to get a lot of pain, a lot of swelling, and then after a day or so, a lot of itching. That's kind of a common reaction, unfortunately.
Yeah, it was exactly what happened to me. Evan, thank you so much for calling. Terry in Mass City, Michigan, it's your turn. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I was just about the mound ant, the field ants and the big mounds.
Yeah.
I found an easy way that works for me is I used a Delta Dust. You know, same thing you've talked about with yellow jackets and things like that, the dust that works. And I just kind of uncover it and dust down the top of that mound and cover it up with grass or something so wind doesn't blow it away or other things don't get into it. And they're gone. They're gone within a couple of days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's all about getting it to the queen. And, you know, I like the idea with these mounds of raking stuff back, and however you treat it, and then you've got untreated soil you can put on the top to cap it. So you really, you know, are trying to lessen any impacts to non-target things. And so whether it's a dust or spray, I think that's a good idea. But I just tend to find when I disturb the nest enough and pull this, it makes it much easier to see the normal channels and in places where they're active.
Yeah.
So I can get the stuff, as I said. To me, it's all about the deeper it goes, the better. And Delta Dust has a longer residual than many insecticides, and that's probably a big advantage for you right there.
Thanks, Terry. Appreciate it. Roger in Lake Zurich, Illinois, we are on to you now. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I have a problem with mosquitoes, and I get about 10 of them a night. I've been using electronic fly swatter and going after them. It takes a while, and it's, you know, you got to get up on a stool and stuff. It's not too safe. A stepladder, actually. And also, I've noticed some of them in the sump pump, but it doesn't look like that's what the problem is. I had my front door, the slab underneath there had some cement mix missing, and I patched that up, but I'm still getting them. I had like 6 of them since last night. What can you do with mosquitoes? Those bug lights don't work. The zapper lights, they don't seem to work. So any ideas? And what can you put in the sump pump if that's where they're coming from?
Well, the sump pump, and it would be something. So, you know, just my take, it was so wet, the mosquitoes were really so bad, and then the dry spell, You know, their numbers have dropped drastically. And so, again, when I've been sitting in the tree stand the last couple of weeks, I haven't seen any, which is a
nice.
Pleasant. But, you know, going back to if they are breeding, there is it's the same insecticide, but they sell it under a different name that we had talked about for fungus gnats. It is a form of bacteria that they use for treating mosquitoes. And they sell it as little mosquito dunks and briquettes and other things for treating ponds and the like. And I could see that in a sump pump, you know, just dropping a little briquette in, and it, you know, the bacteria would prevent mosquito larvae from developing. And so it's a great way. It does nothing for the adults, but again, it's how we shut down breeding going on. And as far as the adults, you know, I would look very carefully if you've got holes in screens or other things that are giving those stinkers so much access. Because, you know, the problem is when you're breathing, you're giving out carbon dioxide, and that's what mosquitoes react to. But normally screens and stuff will keep them out. And, you know, all I can say, and I don't know if you're comfortable with this, but, you know, when we go camping and whatnot, the trick that we use is there's a little unit called a thermocell. And it's basically a little portable unit that has an insecticide impregnated on a little pad, and it uses a little LP container, heats a coil, you put this on, and it gives off fumes. And so like in a tent, when the mosquitoes sneak in and whatnot, you set off the thermocell for only about 5 minutes, and it kills all the mosquitoes, knocks them all down, and then you shut it off. So you don't leave it, you know, it's not something you want to leave on for a long period of time. Now, in a bigger room, it might be a little longer to take hold because, again, you've got to get this stuff up and out. But that would be one option if you just can't solve the riddle of how they're getting in. But that's the first thing I would do, is just make sure everything's tight and the like. And I'm guessing, you know, that we're within, again, a week or two of things just being shut down, unless they're breeding in the sump pump. And that, you know,
then you got to take
normal,
care of that.
But it is possible. And they said then the direction to go is to use this bacterial product. Again, you might see them in hardware stores. I've seen them. They sell only a little pack of two or three little donuts. And I'm guessing you've got such small water volume, as one of those little donuts will probably get you through about 5 years. So, because they do treat relatively large areas of water typically.
I'm wondering if there aren't some leftovers from when I had that opening underneath the slab under the front door, if there's still some floating around. They live for 2 months, right?
Yeah, 4 to 6 weeks. Now, the other thing that happens, you know, of the 53, 54 kinds of mosquitoes we've got here, there is a group of mosquitoes that spend the winter as adults. Most spend the winter as eggs. And typically they'll go into caves, you know, as a place that's cool and sheltered. And so I have seen cases where the Culex mosquitoes have moved into people's basements, you know, and they're not breeding, but again, they're trying to spend the winter. So we have cases of kids that get mosquito bites in January, and it's always because their bedroom's in the basement. So it's not common, but it is possible. But when you get out to be 2 months from the time that they fix that, that's getting the point that it's the mosquitoes got to be coming from somewhere else. The population should have crashed, I think, a couple weeks ago if that was the source.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today as we talk the world of insects. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate from the UW-Madison. He is the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Great to have him along. Thanks for listening in. All of our phone lines are packed, so let's go to Jim in Madison. Jim, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes, I'm trying to identify a beetle that I've seen a number of times here and in this past summer. It's not a problem, but we found it both inside and outside. I have an insect book, and I can't find anything that really identifies it. It's not box elder. It's more of a triangular shape beetle, and bigger than a box elder. And we'll find it once in a while on a screen on the porch outside, and we found them in different places in the house. The colors are brown to black, and on the very, what I'd call the tail of the beetle, it's a dark black. I don't even know if they fly. I've never seen them fly.
It sounds like a marmorated stink bug, but I...
Yeah, that was my first thought. One of the things, you know, as Larry and I were kind of talking about potential subject matter, there is a stink bug called the marmorated stink bug. It's a Asian species, and it's becoming much more commonplace. Especially, we're seeing them in the Madison area big time, and they just kind of hang out. They are capable of flight. If you look at them, they are triangular or shield-shaped.
Yep, exactly.
And if you look at them on the Internet, there's a couple subtle things to look at. They have a little white band in the antennae, and they also have some little creamish or whitish markings more on the back of the abdomen. But I'm just wondering, because most beetles tend to be more elongated.
Yep.
And just considering it, and unfortunately, what we fear that this insect out in the east, in Maryland and Pennsylvania and in New Jersey, has turned into box elder bug, Asian lady beetle, you know, squared. I mean, it's a major fall invader. The numbers are staggering out there. Ooh. We have not seen that here. It's been more of a trickle, but the trickle starting to get bigger. Is just my experience. Yeah. I wonder, they're really harmless other than the nuisance, and because being a stink bug, if you bother them, they give off a very distinct and somewhat unpleasant odor. That's a defense.
Because the size, we were really surprised by that we found them inside. You know, how in the world they don't fly in? How do they get in?
Yeah, they're good at crawling, but they do fly. They are very capable of flight.
I think that's it. In fact, we were in Indianapolis a couple of weeks ago, relatives, and I noticed several of them around inside and some inside of their house.
As I said, one of the reasons I retired is I was fearful of how bad this one could get, because my colleagues out east, it is like a science fiction movie when they really get going. I had a woman tell me that her shop vac, she burned out the motor because they were so thick when she was sucking them up that it ruined her shop vac. And we haven't seen that, and knock on wood, maybe we won't. You know, it's, you know, typical of invasives that when they first get in this country, the first 3 or 4 years, it's just crazy. And then things tend to balance over time. And it's just a question, is that balance going to be acceptable to us? But as I said, I'd look up marmorated stink bug or Asian stink bug, and I bet you that's
the Yeah, that's it. I'll bet anything. Last spring, I was giving a talk at the Garden Expo, and one wandered around in the Dane County Expo Center, and somebody picked it up, and we took a look at it, and yeah, that's a marmorated stink bug.
I was giving a talk down in Janesville last winter, and one was in the ladies' room, and I said it's quite interesting. It honestly has not taken off as fast as I expected, which is good. But you know, talking to PJ, who's running the lab now, and just my observations, it's, you know, I can find one almost any time, one or two, if I go outside and look at our screen porch, and yeah. You know, it never used to be that way.
Yeah.
And it scares my wife when she finds one in her bathroom. How did that, and they're scary.
Yeah. Well, they're, you know, bathroom vent fans and whatnot. So this is, you know, like all these other fall invaders, caulking, screening, you know, a lot of physical ways of trying to keep them out. You may not get them all, but I mean, we even have to check our roof vents to make sure they're screened properly. As I said, you know, the more you can be proactive in building things out, the more reasonable things will be for you.
Jim, thanks a lot for calling. You know, Della emailed us a photo, and there are some worms, maybe an inch and a half, inch long or thereabouts, and kind of curled up. They're at the bottom of her stone wall, the bottom of the house siding. This is an area where they stack firewood.
If she were to call me and not show me the picture, the first thing I'd say, how many legs does the beast have? And I know the answer to this. So if it had 6 legs, it was an insect. These things are going to have dozens and dozens of pairs. It's a millipede, and millipedes feed on organic matter. They live in the soil, and what happens is they migrate around at night, and when the sun comes up, they tend to congregate where it's cool, damp, and dark. And she mentioned it's next to the side of the house. They've got firewood there, so this is just a sheltered place that they're drawn to. They're absolutely harmless, but there are times, I mean, I've got pictures in my files of them 5 inches deep along the foundation. The numbers can be staggering. And what we know is they migrate big distances. Dr. Stan Temple is a good friend, had told me he did an experiment over at his house where he could pretty much track one of these things, and he watched it. And it took it probably about 10 minutes to go 100 yards.
Oh,
so
pretty quick.
You know, the problem is they can migrate from a quarter mile away. You don't know where the source of organic matter is. And what people tend to do is they spray along the foundation. They think that solves the problem. Well, that's not where the problem's coming from. But the reality is a lot of times the problem's coming from places that we have no control over. And so you just sweep them up. If a bunch get in the house, you look for cracks in the foundation, other things to prevent them from getting in, but definitely not anything to worry about.
Madeline and De Pere have something for us. Hi, Madeline. Thanks for calling.
I like to ask about two different articles I saw in the USA Today section of the Green Bay Press Gazette. One was December 24th, 2016, where the article was entitled Feeling Bugged, and it talked about researchers over in Britain who did a study, and it says that they there's huge migration of insects really high above. Like, they looked at for bugs that from 500 to 4,000 feet above the ground, and they were amazed at how many bugs were flying up there. And it said that many of the species are either harmful pests or beneficial, like predators or pollinators. And I wondered, is our country doing any kind of test like that? And also, the second question was about another article that was in the USA Today section, and that was January 5th, 2017, where they talked about the Center for Disease Control had had been developing ticks and spiders that had they actually introduced diseases in them, and then they couldn't account for what happened to some of it, and the reporters who did this investigation had to use the Freedom of Information Act to get this material, but it was heavily redacted. So are you aware of those two articles and what they mean?
Well, the first one, as far as insects migrating in wind patterns, this even almost it predates Phil. When I started 40 years ago, our department was working in that case with some leafhoppers that migrate out of Texas that bring aster yellow disease and other things. So it really has been looked at specifically. You know, we've got some cutworms. There's a large number of pests that don't spend the winter here but classically migrate. And it's really interesting the way these insects have evolved, in that when the temperatures are above 60 degrees, they get up and get caught in the wind. So we get a strong southerly airflow. If the wind changes, the temperature drops, the insects drop to the ground. You know, they have basically evolved to take advantage of the strong wind. So you can find insects get from Texas to Wisconsin in 2 days under the right conditions in the spring. Some years they don't come here. They, you know, the winds blow and they all show up in Indiana. So, you know, we've seen some very interesting things. So it has been researched. It continues to be researched depending on the pests. I have a colleague at Cornell that has worked quite a bit with insects in crop fields in particular, migrating in and trying to use this as a predictive model. Now, I'm not familiar with the tick side. Did you say spiders? They said they were infecting spiders.
Ticks and spiders.
Boy, I don't know of any documented cases of spiders transmitting human diseases. That's, you know, there are some spiders that are poisonous. Now, ticks.
Yeah, like Lyme disease.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, there's no cases of that I'm aware of. You know, I can see where somebody looked at it. But, you know, Lyme disease is a very interesting organism because not only a few types of ticks are capable of transmitting. So, you know, people have tried to infect wood ticks with Lyme disease and not been successful with them transmitting the disease. So, you know, maybe they were referring to research trying to understand that mechanism, but I'm not aware of taking exotic diseases and trying to get them into ticks and then losing track of it. That I'm not aware of.
Okay, there we go. Thank you so much, Madeline, for calling. Jerry in Oconomowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Okay, I just got two things, and then I'll get off the air. First one is you can comment on, I use bleach in the sump pump. Is that helping kill a mosquito larvae? And the other thing in the basin, and the other thing is I use Dawn detergent. I just used it the other day on the box elder beetles, and it just annihilated them right away.
Mm-hmm.
So I use it a pretty heavy dosage, though, you know, in one of those spray things, sprayed it on my building, and they all fell dead because it stops the air oxygen from getting through their skin, I guess.
Yeah, well, it even works faster. The books always talk about the oxygen thing, but it takes, you know, minutes to deprive an insect of enough oxygen to kill it. In my experience, the soaps work on thin-bodied insects. but not hard body. So beetles, they're very ineffective because they don't penetrate the skin. If they penetrate the skin, I think the same phenomena when you see, you know, a bunch of grease on water and you put soap, it just breaks all the enzymes and everything apart internally. Now, the concentrations, when I was referring to mild 1 or 2% solutions, what we have found, if you go stronger than that and you're spraying plants with insecticidal soap, you burn the plants. So really, it's more for plant protection. It's probably nothing wrong with using more concentrated soaps when you're using it as a contact spray. But again, my warning would be careful of plants underneath it, because we see that, like any chemical, if you use too much, it can become phytotoxic. So that is a concern there. Bleach, I can see, it depends on the concentrations. You know, sometimes people give bleach too much credit. We use bleach on the outside of insects to sterilize them for doing experiments, and the insects can live.
No.
You know, so it just depends. If the concentration gets enough, it will kill them, but it isn't as toxic to insects as you might think. On the other hand, I can see in a sump pump that it probably would set up conditions, you know, and there are probably other additives you could use. Mosquitoes don't like clean water. They like contaminated water. The more organic matter and whatnot, the happier most species will be. And so things that reduce that will help. And, you know, I normally don't expect breeding. There's other gnats and stuff I would expect in some pumps more likely than mosquitoes, but it is possible.
There we go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, our guest today. Phil's an entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus, and the former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Questions for him, give us a call. The number to call is 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page with your photos and questions. Back with Phil after the news. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate, and former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. We'll take your questions at 800-642-1234. If you have a chance to go to our Facebook page, please do, because there are a lot of nice insect photos up there. Pretty cool things to look at, and so take advantage of that. Go to our Facebook page. Andrew in Green Bay has a question for you, Phil. Let's go there. Andrew, hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on an organic farm in just outside of Green Bay, and we have a lot of those insect issues, box elder beetles, lady beetles, hornets, too. My issue is that we're certified organic, and I'd prefer not to have to use pesticides on them. I was wondering if you could touch on any organic pest control methods besides a fly swatter. Not only like that, but also maybe spotted wings or Sofila.
Yeah, oh boy, you're coming up with some real stinkers. I, you know, the thing about organic stuff, because it tends to have a narrower host range, you really have to do your homework and match up what the options will be. You know, as we talked before, insecticidal soap, even though it's not naturally occurring, is acceptable in organic production in most cases. I mean, you got to read the labels, because it depends a little bit on how they formulate things. And, you know, that kills soft-bodied stuff, but as we talked about, it only kills on contact. There are a number of bacterial insecticides, very selective. Some only kill caterpillars, some only kill certain kinds of beetles, some only kill mosquito larvae. But these are all naturally occurring strains of bacteria, and that's why they are acceptable. So again, depending on the problem, you've got an option there. But, you know, where it gets very difficult is when you take the whole broad spectrum of, you know, whether you're talking vegetable pests or nuisance pests or whatnot, of coming up with a organic solution. I don't think there is one. As I said, it usually is understanding what the critter is and seeing if we've got some options, you know, most acceptable organic insecticides are naturally occurring. They're the roots of this, the leaves of that. You know, pyrethrum is a classic example. It's a chrysanthemum derivative. It's in many fly sprays. It breaks down in sunlight, so that's really neat. But it's also not neat when you need something with a residual, you know, because if you kill the fly in front of you now, that's fine. But you'd like something that if you sprayed on the wall, it would last for a few days. And, you know, that's where we tend to see a problem. Many natural oils are very good for contact insecticides. So as I said, it does depend on the individual situation, but in most cases, I think you'll find some alternative. But again, finding one magic product, I can't give you that.
Not going to happen, probably.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, Andrew. John in Exceland, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry, Phil. I got a problem with my house. It's a north-facing wall that these insects are, whatever, lighting on, I guess they're doing, and they're attaching themselves by some kind of their mouth part, it looks like, and hanging when I find the few that die and remain there. And they leave this little spot on there that I can't find any way to get it off of there. It's like a 1 to 2 millimeter, probably something from their saliva. And they look, it looks to me like they're a real weak-bodied, 3/4 of an inch type moth with the real skinny little straight wings. Is that ringing any bells?
Well, I mean, typically when we find things kind of glued onto surfaces, it's often insects that have died from fungal diseases. But most of the time, the proteins and body fluids I'm aware of, although could stain, wouldn't sustain themselves. When I hear about, you know, little small dark-bodied structures that stick on siding, you know, the other thing that we see is got nothing to do with the insects, but there is something called an artillery fungus, and it often breeds in wood chips and the like, and it shoots its spores. And, you know, when the spores get on there, they're absolutely unbelievably resilient. And to the point, I mean, we've had insurance companies call because people have filed claims of all the spotting on. And it would be classic on the north side of the house where there's more moisture because that gives the fungus a much better chance to go. And I'm wondering if there's more than one thing going on. You might have, you know, a few insects dying there, might be getting spider webs, whatever. But again, if you've got these relatively round, and look it up on the internet, artillery fungus, you'll see pictures of what the spores look like. And I'm just wondering if that's indeed what's causing the more permanent kind of
well,
spotting.
The spots are really, they're right at the end of that, you know, where they're clinging to the surface. And then they're stuck on there. And, I mean, I hit them with high-pressure water from my hose, not a power sprayer or anything. But, I mean, they still remain stuck, the moth did.
Well, the other thing that I have seen, there are bagworms, which are a type of moth. But the larvae create this little structure. And they literally will glue them on, and they pupate. They make their cocoons inside. The moths go flying away, but the structure is glued on. I mean, it's amazing. But usually if you get up close to it and tear it apart, you can see, again, it's more of a case rather than an insect itself.
Yeah, this is the insect, I'm pretty sure, still attached. But I could be wrong. My eyesight's not what it used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it would make sense, as they said, because, you know, when I see flies that have died from fungus disease and whatnot, they're plastered, almost glued on, but it's not a substantial glue by any means. It's something you can flick off quite easily. And I would think a high pressure hose, there's no way that the insects that die that way could be stuck. So as I said, my other is not the classic bagworm. The bagworm you'll see when you do your first internet search is something that's in white cedar trees and it's relatively big. But there are other species of bagworms that we run into, and that's been my experience. They don't cause any problems other than their casings get so glued onto substrates that you almost have to take a razor blade to kind of get them off,
yeah. John, do like I did. I went to the hardware store and bought myself a nice magnifying glass. That helps me a lot when I have situations just like the one you were talking about or trying to read the fine print on some of the things that I get.
I've got a couple of them, but I couldn't find them.
There you go. Thanks, John. Appreciate the call. Well, Alberta in New Berlin, it is your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good afternoon.
What can we do for you?
I have a son who lives on the south side of Milwaukee who is having a problem with a flea infestation. Is that something that, and he lives near the airport, so there's lots of fields around there. Is that something that occurs naturally, that you get flea infestation?
They have,
it's mentioned, they have pets in the house?
Yes, cats
and
actually.
And they're indoor only?
Well, they're bringing them in when you take, and there was a dog there for a while, and the dog would go out and walk. They would walk it, and of course, then that gave it to the cat.
So, you know, when people have a flea problem, we often ask to see the flea. But I'll tell you that 90% of them are cat fleas, whether on, they're on dog and cats, but we also find them on raccoons and possums. So there is a possibility that wild animals have originally introduced them. The reason, it's much easier to control that flea when it's on dogs than when it's on cats. And people often think it's because I don't like cats why I tell the story, but it has to do with the biology of the animal. Cats by nature are hiding back in closets, underneath furniture and the like, and that's where the breeding is going on. And unless you get to those hot spots, you cannot control the problem. Dogs by nature tend to be out in the open, and so they curl up in the middle of the living room, and so you set off the bomb or do the spray, and it gets to where it needs to go. So the problem with cats is, you know, if the cat spends a lot of time down in the basement where you've got all your boxes and stuff, you got to get into there and get that opened up and vacuumed and potentially treated. And so that's where the difficulty is there. The best kind of treatments is a combination of a contact kill in the bomb, but they also use an insect hormone. And the advantage of the hormone, it's far less toxic than most insecticides. It prevents the eggs from hatching or the larvae from transforming it into adult fleas, and it lasts upwards of 6 months. So, you know, if you use one of these combination treatments and you put it in the right place, it will solve the problem. But as I said, my experience is just because cats get the fleas breeding in out-of-the-way difficult places, you really got to do your homework and you really got to be diligent, because if you miss one spot, you will still have fleas.
Okay, that makes sense, because cats do hide all over the place.
Yeah. So if
you, sometimes you can't even find them. And where do you find these combination?
You know, in most hardware stores, pet stores, indefinitely, you know, sometimes people go to the vets. You know, the veterinarians sometimes have some products available that are not sold over the counter. But as I said, to me, what I'm usually suggesting that is you've got an insect growth regulator to prevent the breeding. You have an insecticide to kill the adult fleas that are present now. And that combination usually works quite well.
Okay, very good.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Alberta. Judy in Elm Grove, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hello there. I have just found some very curious they look like a tiny little worm about an inch long that I think maybe has little teeny tiny like millipede feet at the bottom, but they're most of the time dead and they're curled up. But I have found, and they're in corners of rooms or out in the garage, and they've been under moist areas, but I have no clue what they are, but they've been very prevalent this warm season, and I'm wondering what they are.
No, I think you hit it. They are millipedes. And
oh,
so as
they
I said,
are. Okay.
Yeah. And because our homes are too dry, not suitable environment, they die. I mean, that's why we don't worry about, other than the nuisance problem from them, that anything really bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Stella in Sturgeon Bay.
Hi.
Excuse me. Hi.
I was just calling people. Earlier you were talking about being stung by wasps or yellow jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to share a couple remedies that my husband and I have used very successfully. Years ago, I was stung in the garden, and the only thing I could think of, it just hurt so much, the only thing I could think of was to go in and get an ice cube. And I held an ice cube on it, and I just kept holding ice cubes on it until the pain went away and stayed away. I'd hold it on until it went away, and then when it started again, I'd put it on again. And my husband has very effectively used melaleuca oil, which is commonly known as tea tree oil. You need a high-quality one. It'll smell like turpentine. And he's put that on stings. And it works beautifully. It just takes the pain away, and there's no residual problems.
Interesting. A lot of home remedies, I know after I got zapped a couple weeks ago, it was suggested to me to use meat tenderizer by a friend of mine who is a physician. So, there are lots of ways. I think, I can see where the ice would lessen the swelling, which would definitely affect the pain. It's tough. And the other part of it is when you get stung, your reaction both is individual, but is related to how much venom got injected. And sometimes they get a lot of venom in, sometimes they don't. And so, you do get different reactions. It's really gets quite complicated, as does, bee stings have different venom complements than wasps. And so, sometimes when people say, we tend to think anything that stings us is a bee, but my experience is about 90% of it is wasps.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Stella. Appreciate the call. Let's go back to Facebook for a minute. Nick sent us a cool photo of a, I think it's a...
It's a beetle.
It's and, a grape beetle, maybe, huh?
Grape leaf beetle is a common name it's given. Pelidnota is the name I know it. If you turn this critter, it you know, looks like kind of a big June beetle, but it's much more colorful. But underneath it is a metallic greenish sheen. It's a very attractive beetle. And you know, they chew on grape leaves a little bit, but not enough to be of much concern. So it's more of a curiosity.
This one's on milkweed.
Yeah, probably just hanging out. I that's one thing I don't think they'd try to eat, but they definitely hang out there. And it you know reminds me more of some of the tropical beetles for how colorful it is. But it is one of my favorite Wisconsin beetles, I think is the way I would put it.
Mary and Nina, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I was wondering, I had an incident where I did some laundry for somebody, and they later found out, like a couple weeks later, that their cat had fleas. Mm-hmm. Indoor cat, but it somehow got fleas. They only had a few fleas on them, but I'm really nervous that I'm going to get them in my house. I have all wood floors. I don't want to go through all this chemical stuff and treating my cats. But what the vet had said is if your cats are on a flea treatment that you get through the vet, and it's the safest. If they're on the flea treatment, basically the flea bites them, dies, it can't survive. So potentially, I guess the question is, can it live in the whole environment if you miss spots cleaning or, you know, spraying or whatever you do, as long as that cat is treated?
Well, you know, the fleas will be much more attracted to the cat than anything else. And so if it's not like the flea's going to sit around for, even though they're capable of sitting around for months without feeding, they are going to go to a host as quick as possible. And so, you know, the combination of having any adult fleas, if possibly were left behind, feeding on treated cats should take care of it. The other thing about breeding, and this goes back to that original question when somebody was saying they had a problem, the immature stage of a flea is a maggot-like creature. It's a larva that must feed on the dried blood of its host. That dried blood accumulates where the animal rests. So that's where I was going back to that analogy, that the dogs rest out in the open, so everything is right in front of you. The cats tend to get into places that are hard to get to. But carpeting is the big problem in many cases because that can accumulate a lot of dried blood. Typically, hardwood floors and linoleum and, you know, tiles are not good flea breeding places because there's no place for the blood to accumulate. And so, I would just vacuum if you're concerned. You know, vacuuming in low numbers is a good way to reduce flea numbers, if not control them. But then the big thing, as your vet said, if your cats are treated in a way that any flea that feeds on it will die, the cat
well,
is the...
Well, I'm kind of waiting because my cats are sensitive, and I'm kind of waiting and seeing, and they're going in Friday for a checkup. So I'm just kind of waiting and not really doing it unless we see something.
Oh, no, and that's very reasonable because the most cases the vets are going to be able to read the animal to see if they're picking up any flea bites.
Right.
If there's any sign.
I have dark litter, so I use that crushed up walnut shells, which looks like coffee grounds.
Right.
So I'm changing litter so that it doesn't get misdiagnosed.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess, you know, I'm just kind of hoping for the people that I helped out with that because they have carpeting and they have so many hidey spots for fleas, they're going to spray and everything, but there's going to be somewhere you're going to miss. But they did do a 3-month treatment on the cat.
Mm-hmm.
So with that and spraying around, they should be able to eradicate that and get rid of them.
Right. You know? And, you know, in this discussion of potentially breaking or picking it up outdoors, as I said, the wild animal hosts, you know, you pretty much shut down. It's interesting. In Florida, they have to spray their yards, I'm told, to control fleas.
Well, he sprayed the porch because a stray cat's been on the porch and got into the garbage. They figure that's how it happened because this cat's never been outside since they've adopted it as a kitten. So
In many cases where I've run into cases, even where people have had cat fleas and no pets, what we tend to find out, something crazy like a raccoon is in the chimney or, you know, as I said, it's got to be brought in. They're not found everywhere. You basically have to get in contact with it when an infected animal is being
Yeah, and then and it couldn't get up into my attic and my old insulation fleas, couldn't it?
They're attracted very quickly to animals. And one of the interesting things, sometimes pets get banished when they're found they've got fleas, and all that does is cause the fleas to get very hungry and bother the people in the house. Now, they can't breed off of human blood, but they can make people itchy and the like. Yeah, no.
Great. Okay. That's good to know. All right. Thank you. It's pretty safe to go over there once they spray and have their cat treated.
I think you're okay going over there. I'd be cautious bringing my pets until we were about three or four months.
Oh, no, I don't bring my pets there, but I didn't know if I'd bring them over on my clothing somehow, if they would just jump off me, if they got on me.
It is hypothetically possible. My experience, when fleas are bad, you don't miss it. They're jumping all over your socks, and you know it, and you can deal with that. But, you know, as I said, the fleas would be much preferred to be on the pets and not on people.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate the call. Let's give Jeff in Fox Lake a chance to join in here. Hi, Jeff.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I just had a real quick story to share. My daughter saw the chicken pecking at something on the lawn, and she got a pail, and was this huge caterpillar, and you got to think carrot size, baby carrot, but just as orange as could be, probably 3 inches long. I never seen anything that big, and it had the most beautiful fake eyes on it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty incredible find. And then I was wondering, they looked it up and thought it was a sphinx moth.
Yeah, and probably Pandora's sphinx is the species, because they do have an orange form. They do have a darker form, a black, you know, two or three different color forms. But that's what I was thinking right away, as a Pandora sphinx, which you find on grapes and Virginia creeper, some of the viney things.
Oh, okay. I do have a fair amount of wild grapes growing that we kind of leave go, so we can have some wild grapes. But the other real quick thing I had is I have... What I often find in organic matter, say like what it is, the corn stalk peel, is I'll find larvae, and it's a large white one, and I have if I identified it correctly, it's a bumblebug beetle larvae. But I'm wondering, where would that beetle be and what would it look like? I can't ever say that I've ever seen a beetle, but I find larvae quite common.
Yeah. There's a whole bunch of grubs that you get in decaying organic matter. Many of them belong to the scarab beetle family, of which the bumbleflower beetle is one of them. It's weird. Bumbleflower beetles are more of a spring critter. They would remind you of a bumblebee. I mean, unless you did a double take, you'd probably misidentify it. So that might be what's going on. Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Bill emailed to say that you identified a biting gnat a few years ago and said that it was by rushing water, you suggested, and in fact, they have a creek nearby. They bothered us in the spring only. Now they're biting all the time. Any ideas what it might be?
Yeah, so I know it's a black fly. People call them buffalo gnat sometimes, is another common name. And typically, most of the years, we have a spring flush, and that's it. But there are multiple species. In my experience this year, in fact, Larry and I were talking about it during the break, is that we've seen black flies all summer long. Not so much in Madison, but out by the Wisconsin River, where I said I've got some friends who've got some property that I spend quite a bit of time in. Even last night, I was getting black flies messing with me. And it's just, again, not typical, but not out of the realm of possibility. You can get multiple hatches, and for whatever reason, this has been is probably as bad a season-long black fly season as I've ever seen.
Well, it's hopefully that'll be over soon, though.
Yeah, I every time I go out there, I figure it's got to be done now. It's got to be done now. And it's interesting, the black flies, many of them are bird feeders, and so they're not necessarily biting, they're just hanging around. But there are species that would gladly bite people, so.
Well, Phil, it's always a pleasure. You'll be back in December?
Yes.
Come back in December, and we'll talk again about insects. And you know what? We have insects in December here in Wisconsin, often in the house. So we'll visit with Phil Pelletieri about that in a couple of months. Right now, I want to thank you so much for listening. We'll talk tomorrow about how to get your chimney ready for the winter months. I'm kind of looking forward to that as well. And then Michelle Good, in just a minute or two, will be talking on Chapter Day from the book Girl Waits with Gun by Amy Stewart. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.